Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing discussion of important health issues. In this dialogue, we will try to explore as many different topics as possible. Time permitting, I will be taking calls on important health issues. I'm not in my studio today. I'm in the midst of a journey that will probably culminate in an interview with South African President Mbeki on his current position on AIDS. I'm going to be on the last leg of this, hopefully flying over to interview him in the next 2 weeks. But I'll be hopefully broadcasting some of the programs from Cuba. And I'll be interviewing some of their leading health practitioners on the subject of how they're treating AIDS successfully using natural techniques. Now, whether or not you agree or disagree of the actual cause of AIDS, the fact is that people are sick. And the conditions that they're sick from could be from many different causes. Well, what are they doing to get these people well, irrespective of the underlying cause? Also, why is it that there are people living in certain areas of the world much longer than even their neighbors 50 miles away? I'll be going to these remote locales, into the rainforest. Next Tuesday, I'll be in rainforest. And Thursday, I'll be in mountain ranges. And if my technology is okay and we get our satellite hookups, I'll be broadcasting live from there, giving you my day-to-day reports of the interviews I have with the elders, the shamans, the medicine people, and some public health officials who are traveling with me, who will be interpreting from the language, because I don't know all these different languages. In fact, some of the languages spoken in these areas are unique to that particular area. But there are lessons to be learned, and that's what we need to do. Go wherever there is a lesson and study it. See how we might be able to incorporate their message back into our culture. Now, let's go to some of the issues that that generally we would not hear much about. Recently, the American Dental Association released a statement suggesting that there really is no problem about mercury. Now, if you go to the webpage, GaryNull.com, you'll see that there's a very comprehensive report, all cited with peer-reviewed journals, no editorializing, on the dangers of mercury, including the mercury in your mouth from silver fillings. Let me add to that, which challenges the position of the American Dental Association. This comes from the Environmental Working Group, and this is their latest paper. It is entitled, Mercury is a Major Public Health Problem. Like lead, mercury is toxic to the developing brain. It blocks the natural formation and migration of nerve cells and alters brain growth and development. The fetus is most vulnerable to mercury, and the principal source of exposure is fish consumed by the mother. EPA estimates that between 60 and 75% of mercury in the U.S. waters is from man-made pollution, and that coal-fired power plants are the largest and only unregulated source. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 10% of American women, roughly 7 million women, already have so much mercury in their blood that if they became pregnant, it would pose a threat to the developing fetus. In July of 2000, the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Mercury Toxicity estimated that 60,000 children each year are born at a significantly increased risk of adverse neurological effects from mercury. According to the committee, current exposure levels could result in an increased number of children, quote, who have to struggle to keep up in school and who might require remedial classes of special education, unquote. The government's failure to control mercury has turned many highly nutritious fish species into hazard health for pregnant women. Now, what I would suggest and have in a memo to the Environmental Working Group is that this is a major step forward. I appreciate this work. When I examined their resources from which they gathered their material, I found an oversight, a major oversight. They did not include the mercury in amalgams that fill cavities. And that indeed is the largest single body burden of mercury. Because a lot of pregnant women don't eat fish. In fact, the average American doesn't eat fish. But almost every pregnant woman has between 1 to 12 mercury fillings in her mouth. So if you do not take into account the 24-hour-a-day mercury exposure to cavity, amalgams, then you're underestimating the toxic reaction. Also, let's say that a person does have a piece of fish, and let's say it's like swordfish that does have mercury. That person only may have fish once a week, once a month, and it's not seasonal. But your teeth are every day. Toxicity from it every day. So I would hope that the Environmental Working Group, who does really outstanding work, and this is certainly not a criticism of them at all, it is merely a suggestion that they go back and examine all the work. And my paper, which is there for them and anyone to use, in fact, that's what it's for, it's a public service white paper, they would have even more information to add to what they have that would even make the alarm even larger than what it is. Next issue. Well, you thought your lawyers were a little more articulate, more clever in how they think, better able to put words into the right perspective. This comes from the Bar Association, reported in the Massachusetts Bar Association Lawyers Journal. The following are questions actually asked of witnesses by attorneys during trials, and in certain cases, the response is given by witnesses. I'll just go through some of these. Now, doctor, isn't it true that when a person dies in his sleep, he doesn't know about it until the next morning? The youngest son, the 20-year-old, how old is he? Were you present when your picture was taken? Were you alone or by yourself? Was it you or your younger brother who was killed in the war? Did he kill you? How far apart were the vehicles at the time of the collision? You were there until the time you left. Is that true? How many times have you committed suicide? Question. So the date of conception of the baby was August 8th? Answer, yes. And what were you doing at the time? I'm not making any of this up. This comes from the Bar Association. Whoa. And then they go from being lawyers to judges or to the Supreme Court or to becoming legislators. All right. Question. She had three children, right? Answer, yes. How many were boys? Answer, none. Were there any girls? Question. You say the stairs went down to the basement. Answer, yes. And these stairs, did they also go up? Question. Mr. Slattery, you went on a rather elaborate honeymoon, didn't you? Answer. I went to Europe, sir. Question. And you took your wife? Question. How was your first marriage terminated? Answer. By death. Question. And whose death was it terminated? Question. Can you describe the individual? Answer. He was about medium height and had a beard. Question. Was this a male or female? Question. Yes, I've seen some of the people I've dated. That'd be a hard question. Question. Is your appearance here this morning pursuant to a deposition notice which I sent to your attorney? Answer, no. This is how I dress when I go to work. Question, doctor, how many autopsies have you performed on dead people? Answer, all my autopsies are performed on dead people. Question, all your responses must be oral, okay? What school did you go to? Answer, oral. Question, do you recall the time you examined the body? Answer, the autopsy started at 8:30. question. And Mr. Dennington was dead at the time? Answer, no. He was sitting on the table wondering why I was doing an autopsy. Question, you were not shot in the fracas? Answer, no. I was shot midway between the fracas and the navel. Question, are you qualified to give a urine sample? Answer, I have been since early childhood. Question, doctor, before you performed the autopsy, did you check for a pulse? Answer, no. Did you check for blood pressure? No. Did you check for breathing? No. So then, is it possible the patient was alive when you began the autopsy? No. How can you be so sure? Because his brain was sitting on my desk in a jar. But could the patient still be alive nevertheless? It's possible that you could be alive and practicing law somewhere. Question, what's your date of birth? Answer, July 15th. Question from the lawyer, what year? Every year. Question, what gear were you in the moment of impact? Answer, Gucci sweats and Reeboks. And so on. So, never feel too bad if you can't articulate some questions occasionally. Because it seems our so-called best and brightest can't either. This comes from Mind Aid. Our Rita DiCarlo, thank you for sending this. This involves something from Leonard Frank. The American Psychiatric Association's 2001 Task Force Report on the Practice of Electroconvulsive Therapy, Recommendations for Treatment, Training, and Privileging, second edition, page 102, states, a quote, in light of the accumulated body of data dealing with structural effects of electroconvulsive therapy, brain damage should not be included in the electroconvulsive consent form as a potential risk of treatment, unquote. Now, here's what's important. The American Psychiatric Association is saying we do not want people to be aware of the fact that we're going to create brain damage. And yet, every single study of electroconvulsive therapy shows that the only reason that would have any therapeutic value is because it creates brain damage. Now, I do not believe that it creates a therapeutic benefit, but arguing on the side of the psychiatrist, they're going to say, well, the person went through euphoria. Yes, and you could come out of a car wreck and be euphoric because you're in a state of shock. Shock will create euphoria. That is not the same as benefit to the patient. Well, but the patient no longer recognizes what they were depressed about. That's correct, because you've destroyed permanently through brain damage cells that held the memory. Now, what you've also destroyed is everything associated with that same memory. All other events, sensations, feelings, perceptions, and knowledge. And that does not mean the person will not become depressed again, which every single study shows they do. Even the supporters of electroconvulsive therapy recognize that short-term benefits only last about 6 months. But what's revealing here, and why I want to focus on this for just a second, is it shows that there was intent. Now, keep in mind, when you can show intent to do harm, that changes it from an innocent mistake to intentional deception. And therefore, the American Psychiatric Association, in my opinion, should be challenged on changing this so that it's clear in every consent form that the intent of electroconvulsive therapy is to cause brain damage, because that's the only way it works. And they're saying here that they wanted to exclude it. And that means that they would be deceiving the patient by giving him some assurance that it was not causing the damage it does. So for those who've wondered about motive, I just gave it to you and this was actually found by Leonard Frank. Thank you, Leonard, for finding that, and Rita, for passing it on to me. This comes from one of our listeners, Don Whites, and it's entitled, another victory in our struggles against forced drugging and forced treatment. And it's from June 15, 2001, from the Toronto Star. Prodigy wins right to refuse drugs. Medication would slow mentally ill man's thinking, court says. From Tracy Tyler, legal affairs reporter. A physics prodigy who suffers from manic depression has triumphed over two psychiatrists in a long-running court battle over their right to treat him with mood-altering drugs. Professor Scott Starson has the right to refuse the drugs that could slow his thinking down to normal levels. The Ontario Court of Appeal ruled yesterday. Starson understands he is mentally ill and that refusing treatment could end up keeping him confined to a psychiatric hospital. But he has also concluded that taking the drugs would prevent him from engaging in the scientific research that has given his life meaning, a development he feels would be, quote, worse than death, unquote, the appeal panel said. Professor Starson is an exceptionally intelligent man, according to Justice James Carthy. John Larskin and Stephen Gouge said in upholding the judge's decision and overturning a lower court's ruling that said that he should be treated with drugs. And Pierre Nouz, director of the Linear Accelerator Center at Stanford University, describes Professor Starson's thinking in the field of physics as, quote, 10 years ahead of his time. Starson represented himself before the court. And now here is what is important about this. I read as much on the background of this case as I could to find out about this man. I believe both sides have it wrong. I believe Professor Starson has it wrong, his lawyer has it wrong, the court has it wrong, and the opposing psychiatrists have it wrong. They have all assumed that because he has a hyper-vigilant personality, that his mind thinks in very accelerated rate, and he has quantum logical jumps. Hence, his mind is not linear. It doesn't 1 and 2 and 3, it goes 1 to 1,000 to 1,000,000. That is not normal. And therefore, something's wrong with him. And they have taken this highly excitable, not angry, just excitable, personality, which many creative people are, and they have deemed that an illness and had been trying to force him to take the drugs, the antidepressants. And then when you blame someone for not being normal, when you criticize them, when you put them down, which we in our society have a proclivity of judging people without knowing them and even thinking we have the right to do so, which we do not. But we do it all the time, irrespective. And everybody feels that they have a right to be this judge. But in this case, think of the consequences. You take someone who just doesn't think like everybody else because they're unique. They're very brilliant. They have a gift. And they're actually honoring the gift productively. Great science is coming out of this mind's mind. And he's sharing it. And we're benefiting from it. But because he's not doing it in the way other people have been conditioned and taught to do it, he is now considered a disease, to which psychiatrists give him the cure. But he says, no, I don't want that, because when I did it, it slowed down my thinking. Maybe groggy. I couldn't facilitate my thoughts. But they said, but you're being properly treated. All the psychiatrists agree. You need to be properly treated with medication because you have a brain disease. I cannot see where he has any brain disease. There is nothing that they presented that shows that this man is anything more than unique. And since when should we be judging uniqueness in a constructive way as a disease in a negative way? So good for him. Congratulations to this very important prodigy. The world has many of them. My concern is how many other prodigies, how many people who were not willing or even desiring to march to everyone else's beat were made to feel so alienated, so ridiculed, so much a source of other people's insecurity that they felt threatened, that they destroyed the person's desire to even use their gift, causing many people to withdraw into a shell, or to drink, or to do drugs, or just to become reclusive. And then who benefited from the gift that they were given? No one. Least of all themselves and enjoying the wonder of their own life. We must hold a lot more tolerance in front of us for things that are different than us. There is no one who should have the right to say we must all conform to a particular way of thinking. That is a mind think. One of the things I like about this station and other stations like it is that I may agree or disagree with a particular program, but I certainly respect the freedom to be able to say things. If an audience agrees or disagrees with you, they can turn you on or turn you off. But what happens if we're all taught that there's only one kind of ideology? Right, left, independent, communist, Marxist, capitalist? That's not what it's for. And yet in our society, more than ever, anyone who's not like you is perceived as a threat, and you associate with only people like yourself. So psychiatrists are trying to get all of us to believe that there's a single model of behavior that we should all be like. And if you start looking at that behavior, it excludes everything that's normal and everything that is autonomous and everything that's unique and everything that's exceptional. They'd have us believe that we're all like a box of Wheaties, consistent in crunch and flavor and taste and sugar sweeted, all through the help of their drugs, psychotherapy, and psychosurgery and electroconvulsive therapy. And we're coming very close to believing that we all went in Hillary's village. Now think well on this. And I haven't heard a word in the rest of the press about this case. This takes us to another area. And this comes from 10 ways to spot anti-vitamin bias in a scientific study. This is from Andrew Saul in his The Doctor Yourself newsletter. And I'm going to cite this only about 2 pages long because there is an ongoing attack right now against herbs, vitamins, supplements. I know because I've done my homework on this and have been involved in this struggle my entire life, what's behind it, who's behind it, and the techniques they're using. This is because the pharmaceutical company wants to dominate the vitamin market. Remember, the largest makers of vitamins in the world are the large pharmaceutical companies. Number one maker of vitamin C is Hoffman La Roche. Same people who made Valium. But when you are held in check on the prices you can charge for a very inexpensive commodity, then you can't exploit that. Well, Hoffman La Roche was found guilty in the largest trial of its type in the United States, where 7 other corporations, multinational corporations and pharmaceutical industry representatives were found guilty. A total of some $700 million in fines was paid. One man went to jail out of all of them, just one. And it's as if it was a non-story because they had the resources. These are multi-billion dollar companies to pay off these fines. And they were trying to price fix. They did. They price fixed vitamins. Even pennies added up when you count how many pounds of vitamins they sell to how many people. Well, they're the ones that if they can pass the Codex Alimentarius, which they are in the process of trying to do, and harmonize our vitamins or continue the attack in America to get re-regulated, then you wouldn't be able to have your vitamins as you do now. You would have to have them by prescription above a very low potency, or some would be banned altogether. So now where you want a vitamin C, you can buy it inexpensively. If it went the way of Poland, Norway, Australia, Germany, and France, you could pay up to $50 for the same bottle of vitamin C that you're buying now for $4. And yet the vitamin maker, the manufacturer, is the one who would make the enormous amount of profit. So now you at least know who the principal players are. And, of course, I have all this documented in great details. And it's on my website. So you can go there and look under social and public health issues, Codex Alimentarius. And so when you see the New York Times or Jane Brody attacking the danger of this to danger of that, just remember, These same people are not going out of their way to tell you the dangers of over-the-counter non-prescription medication, nor deadly prescription medications, nor the power of people who've changed their lives for the better because they've taken control of their life. It's all about control in the end. Everything and all the major conflicts are about control. So here's how you can determine. So that's why I found some of these very important. Number one, where's the beef? How much of the original study is quoted in the media? Are you just getting factoids or are data provided? Has a journalist writing about the subject actually read the original paper? Now, I'll tell you why that's important. Recently, vitamin C was attacked as causing cancer in humans. Everywhere I went, I was on tour at the time, I saw this coming up in newspapers. So what I do, I contact the university, I got the original data, and, well, it had nothing to do with humans. Nothing. Zero. In fact, it had nothing to do with animals, not rats, nothing. It was a hypothesis about what someone observed in a test tube. Well, anyone who has a background in chemistry knows that vitamin C goes through multiple changes in the body before it's used by the cell. The test tube has no changes. Therefore, anything you observe in a test tube cannot be extrapolated to the human body because of the biochemical processing, conjugation changes that occur in reduction in the Krebs cycle, etc., in the body. So, the author, in his actual report, stated, do not, under any circumstances, extrapolate this to suggest that I am saying that it causes cancer. That's exactly what they did. They said it caused cancer. So unless people are diligent or resourceful enough to know what they're reading, you're not going to know if something's been quoted accurately. Number two, what exactly was studied and how? Was it in vitro, a test tube, or in vivo, animal? Was there a clinical study on the people? Or is it its application to real life a matter of conjecture? Now, I'll give you an example of that. For years, people only studied a single nutrient against a single disease. In spite of that, they still found efficacy and safety in over 100,000 studies. I took a look at this and I said, but nobody lives just by one small amount of a nutrient. And no one's done the study to see what happens when you put all the nutrients together, including lifestyle and behavior and emotions. And hence, that's why I did the 10-year program with over 10,000 individuals on reversing the aging process, the health support groups. And we collected hard, objective data, data that would not be refuted, and had outside, independent, paid medical biostatistician review it. I had nothing to do with it. Versus a drug company that every study, they control who does the research and how it's interpreted, and time and again, negative studies on a drug are never published. They're killed. So you never see, oh, gee, these people died, these people got worse, the drug didn't work. Well, to be completely objective, after the study was designed and I passed it before a group of physicians for their review and the lifestyle changes and all these parameters were measured, at the end of it, when blood work up and blood pressure and met weight and everything, then these were sent out, the data was sent out and interpreted. And then, whatever that was, then by another group of people, it was sent out for peer review and then publication. And indeed, almost 18 different articles have appeared in peer-reviewed scientific journals based upon the study results. You would know it because no mass media has picked it up. None. If you have a toxic drug that kills people, you can get a front-page positive news and it helps you on claims it'll make some promise to you. Change people's lives using the first holistic synergistic approach, where it's not isolated to a single food or a single nutrient, but how people actually live, the reality of life, integrated concepts, is as if it's a non-story. Yet it's the first such studies done in American history. So then you start to realize, gee whiz, it's not just building a better mousetrap and understanding how health works and disease manifests. It's who benefits from it. And if the wrong people don't benefit from your message, it'll never see the light of day. That's another lesson we've learned. Number three, follow the money. Who paid for the study? Cash from food processors, pharmaceutical giants, and others with deep pockets decides what gets studied and how. It is very difficult, if not impossible, for researchers to present findings that embarrass their financial backers. Published research will often indicate sources of funding, possibly at the end of the paper in an acknowledgments paragraph. If not, correspondent addresses of principal authors are invariably provided. Write and ask. Give you an example. There was a study published all over Europe, and it made it in the United States in the mid-1980s, talking about how chocolate was actually good for you, and it had these benefits. I said, that's just not possible. So I went to the original research. It took me 2 months to track the sources of who actually funded it. Ended up being a candy maker funded it. And it was done in Europe. And all the people associated with the project had received substantial research grants from the candy maker and a foundation that was supplying the research through the vis-a-vis the candy maker. They decided how the study's results would be interpreted. It was never made public, meaning the raw data, so we had no way to know if they were objective or not. But what later happened is one of the authors of that study tried to publish the results that showed that what they did was wrong, and he was sued because he had signed a confidential agreement and could not then present the truth. That's how much of a hold commercial groups have over the dissemination of information. 4, check the dosages. Any vitamin C study using less than 2,000 milligrams a day is a waste of time. Any vitamin E suggesting less than 400 units is a waste of time. Any study using less than 1,000 milligrams of niacin a day is a waste of time. All low-dose studies are set up to fail. Low doses of vitamins do not cure major diseases. Large doses can. And again, people are not stupid. Look, if you were going to get a research grant for $1 million to study vitamin C in cancer, and if it was going to be paid for by a pharmaceutical company or the U.S. Public Health Service, if you're smart, you're going to set the study up at 500 milligrams a day because it's not going to do anything at that level with cancer. But if you set it up at 20,000 milligrams or 50,000 milligrams 3 times a week intravenous, you don't know. It may actually help the patient. At 200,000 milligrams, it could actually cure some people. You're not about to go there. You're never going to know what the positive benefits are because you're not going to take a risk. Too much to lose politically. You can even check the supplement, number 5, check the supplement used, because a lot of vitamins are natural or synthetic, and the synthetics do not work as well as the natural. And number 6, use the Linus Pauling principle. Read the entire study and interpret the data for yourself. Do not rely upon the summary or conclusions. Now, here's the hard part of this. I have had thousands of studies I've read where the conclusions absolutely contradict what is stated in the heart of the material. Now, you think, well, how's that possible? Wouldn't the conclusions support the material? It should, ideally, but it doesn't. And number 8, watch out for those slams that say get all your vitamins you need from your daily diet. Vitamins are dangerous if you take too many of them. Excess vitamins are wasted, just causing your urine to turn yellow. More research is needed before supplements can be recommended. There's no scientific support for large doses. These are the common arguments. None of that's true. But the public wouldn't know that. Do you know there are over 1,500,000 studies on supplements? That's 1,500,000. So we know about the pharmacology. We know toxicological data. And we know efficacy. But as long as people don't do their homework, they'll never know how many lies are being told. 9, watch for pontifical public recommendations at the end of an article, such as vitamins can do some things, but they're bad for everything else. We're better off not popping a vitamin pill. What are you going to pop? A French fry? What are you going to pop? A Coca-Cola? A McDonald's? That's okay to pop, but it's not. Use the media backwards. The more headlines about a particular study, the more politically charged the subject, and the less likely that the reporting or the original study is positive towards vitamins. Negative news sells newspapers and magazines, gets lots of viewers. Positive drug stories do get headlines, of course. Positive vitamin stories do not. Is this a conspiracy? You mean with shady people all sitting around a shaded table in the dark and black room? Of course not. It is nevertheless an enormous public health problem with enormous consequences. Consider what might be called Saul's Law of the media. Press and television coverage of a vitamin study is inversely proportionate to the study's clinical usefulness. In other words, the more media hoopla, the worse the research. Truly valuable research does not scare people. It helps people get well. There are thousands of scientific references on this. If you go to GaryNall.com, I have tens of thousands of citations of how we have been misled on this. Now, this comes from Bob Herbert from in America. The AIDS virus is surging like a prairie fire through black communities in the United States. The epidemic is not getting anything like the attention it deserves. The Center for Disease Control now believes that one in every 50 black Americans is infected with HIV. That is an astonishing statistic. AIDS is the leading cause of death for African Americans between the ages of 25 and 44. While blacks are just 13% of the U.S. population, more than half of all new HIV infections occur among blacks. Blacks are 10 times more likely than whites to be diagnosed with AIDS and 10 times more likely to die from it. This would be a good time for black Americans to say enough. Disease is concentrated in the inner city neighborhoods where AIDS orphans have become ubiquitous. The suffering caused by the disease is all but unbearable. In some cases, entire families are being wiped out. You can put away the notion that AIDS is a disease that primarily affects gay white males. That story has changed. Black women, for example, are becoming infected at a frightening rate. They account for 64% of all new infections among women in the U.S. Well, there's a problem with this. And here's what happens. This was an article entitled The Quiet Surge. The Quiet Scourge. I would challenge virtually every statement he said. Here's an example of who do you believe. There was a time when the media had used up all of its currency in what it was doing with AIDS. And so, once again, now there's a new target. Now the target's black Americans. And I looked at the statistics, and you do not have an epidemic in African Americans of AIDS. And you do not have an epidemic of AIDS in ghettos. What you do have in ghettos, white or black or Latino, is you have a certain relatively small percentage using drugs. And people using drugs generally have hepatitis C and B and malnutrition, completely shattered immune systems. They're generally drinking, have cirrhosis of the liver. They'll have virtually every virus and bacteria that we know of. And there's no hygiene either. I had seen long before the AIDS epidemic young people coming into Trafalgar Hospital and dying 17, 18, 19 years of age. They did not represent the average youth within their community. The average youth were not using heroin. We have overblown, for political reasons and special interest reasons, all of these so-called epidemics. So this person is now trying to target African Americans. Now, why? Because once you go to the people within a community and you say, your community is infected, its whole family is being wiped out, then suddenly you get everyone on red alert. Everyone gets overly diligent, and that's where you make wrong choices. And when you make a choice to suddenly believe that everyone is capable of being infected just because you're a black person, that is absurd. There is no rational mind that could, or reasonable mind that could accept this. But a hyper overstimulated, fearful mind could. And that's the soil in which they plant these seeds of hysteria and paranoia. Behind that generally will come public health clinics that will test everyone. Behind that comes vaccine recommendations. Behind that comes automatic or mandatory testing recommendations. where then school boards and individuals get together and say we should test all of our kids. Now, there's a problem with this. The problem is that suddenly you have violated people's basic constitutional rights, freedom of protection, including protection against discrimination. And the very people who have historically been discriminated against would then discriminate against their own if it were thought that this was something that was infective. Not all would do that, but people exploit people's fear, cause chaos. And when chaos reigns, you have no stability of thought. For years, we had chaos within the war on AIDS, purely for the self-serving interests of those who benefited from it. Behind it all is the pharmaceutical company. Next in line to them are the fat checks that are received by the scientists who are for hire to say anything about AIDS. Behind that are the foundations, over 75,000 of them, that make nice fat salaries from this. Ask them what they've done to reverse AIDS. The answer is nothing. All their ads, all their money, nothing. And yet there are 15,000 long-term survivors of AIDS who simply made a choice to change their lifestyle. Today they're healthy and well. I've been around the country filming them for a new special. There are organizations who are out there tracking large groups of people and accumulating a database. And we have Hugh Christie to thank for that, for his Herculean efforts in bringing these people's backgrounds and history together. Pharmaceutical company, CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, National Cancer Institute, Robert Gallo, they do not want that kind of information spread. Because if you were to say, how many long-term survivors do you have who have been using AZT and DDI and DDC? 15 years or more. How many? Bring them forward. You're going to have very few people standing. And then you say, well, here are 15,000 long-term survivors who did not use your drugs and who are healthy and well today, most seroconvert. And what is the answer they're going to give you? The public is going to say, well, hold on a second. Then how did they get well? Why didn't we hear about them? And why was everything AZT, AZT? Put time on your side. Get the test. We have not been given the truth at any time in this war. And so I'm asking religious leaders or their parish members, if you hear right now, because this campaign's ongoing on now, if you hear people coming in to have meetings within your parish in black communities, Latino communities, about identifying the epidemic that's sweeping your community, please be aware that these people are representatives of the pharmaceutical industry, hiding that representation in order to get you screened and tested. And there are 65 different illnesses, including the common flu shot, measles, herpes, diabetes, arthritis, that could cause you to test positive. And they're specifically and cleverly getting women who have been drug users tested. And then saying, oh, look at the percentage of black women pregnant. Well, here's what they've done. This is extremely deceitful on their part. And they must be challenged. They know which hospitals primarily service indigenous people, and specifically primary drug users. How many of those women who come in there then represent the average African American or Latino female? Less than 1%. But they will take the 1% who do and test that. Let's say they test 100 women at Hull Hospital in Brooklyn, which has got a high percentage of people who come in there who are drug addicts. The drug addict has a sewer for a bloodstream. It is the most incredibly toxic bloodstream. I have examined the blood under the microscope of so many drug addicts for years. You name it, you're going to find it there. So if they took 100 women, and if 100 out of 100 women were African American, and they would be, and they're who are pregnant, you're going to test about 80% of them positive. even though they don't have AIDS, they have antibodies that would respond as if they did. You then can say, legitimately say, 80% of the African Americans in this one community were positive for the virus that causes AIDS. And then suddenly it may, my God, 80% of the women, the black women, have AIDS? That's how it could be interpreted. I've watched throughout my life to this point how many times things are taken out of context or placed into a particular context to gain an argument that have nothing to do with reality. I've seen how they played this. That is to say that you don't even have 1% of African American women who have AIDS. They would make it seem as if there was a 80%. And there, when you have that kind of numbers, you can get legislation that then creates public community health service centers to get mandatory testing for all black and Latinos. And then right behind that, I promise you, within 2 years, you're going to start seeing the AIDS vaccine. And guess who's going to have it mandatory? African Americans and Latinos. By the way, do you think the nice white people in Scarsdale are going to have their kids getting an AIDS vaccine? No way. You watch how this works. You think I'm wrong on it? Watch. I have eyes and ears everywhere. Everywhere. And I know what they're planning. These are very, very clever people. And business-wise, they're smart. If you can make $50 on every one of those tests, and you can make people come back every 6 months to be retested, and if the government pays for it, you're looking at $100 billion a year industry. And they're going to start in your churches. So be wary of the person who comes to you wanting to help you, help with the scourge of AIDS, an epidemic of AIDS. Remember what I've told you. They're coming. They're there already. Do not be taken by them. All right? I'm Gary Knoll, talking about health issues and trying to focus on some of the issues you generally don't hear a whole lot about. This comes from John Rappaport. And it's called, and it's in Nexus, School Violence, the Psychiatric Drug Connection. Excuse me. The massacre at Columbine High School in Lytton, Colorado, took place on April 20, 1999. Astonishingly, for 8 days after the tragedy, during thousands of hours of primetime television coverage, virtually no one mentioned the word drugs. Then the issue was open. Eric Harris, one of the shooters at Columbine, was on at least one prescription drug. The New York Times, on April 29, 1999, and other papers reported that Harris was rejected from enlisting in the Marine Corps for medical reasons. A friend of the family told the Times that Harris had been treated by a psychiatrist. And then, several sources told the Washington Post that the drug prescribed as treatment was Luvox, manufactured by Solvay. 2 days later, the drug issue was gone. Luvox is of the same class as Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft. They are labeled SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They attempt to alleviate depression by changing the brain levels of the natural substance serotonin. Luvox has a slightly different chemical configuration from Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft, and it was approved by the FDA for obsessive compulsive disorder, although many doctors apparently prescribe it for depression. Prozac is the widely popular Eli Lilly antidepressant, which has been linked to suicidal and homicidal actions. It is now given to children. Again, its chemical composition is very close to Luvox, the drug that Harris took. Dr. Peter Bregan, the eminent psychiatrist and author of Toxic Psychiatry, Talking Back to Prozac and Talking Back to Ritalin, told me, with Luvox, there is some evidence of a 4% rate of mania in adolescents. Mania, for certain individuals, could be a component of grandiose plans to destroy large numbers of other people. Mania can go over the hill to psychoses. Dr. Joseph Tarantolo is a psychiatrist in private practice in Washington, D.C. He is the president of the Washington chapter of the American Society of Psychoanalytic Physicians. Tarantolo states, all the SSR, including Prozac and Luvox, relieve the patient of feeling. He becomes less empathetic, as in, I don't care much, which means it's easier for me to harm you. If a doctor treats someone who needs a great deal of strength just to think straight and gives one of these drugs, that could push him over the edge into violent behavior. In a syndicated column of July 9, 1998, Bregan states, I have no doubt that Prozac can cause or contribute to violence and suicide. I've seen many cases. In a recent clinical trial, 6% of the children became psychotic on Prozac, and manic psychosis can lead to violence. The article concluded, in addition to the case of Kip Kingle, who had been a user of Prozac, Kinkle was the shooter in the May 21, 1998 school massacre in Springfield, Oregon. There are much less publicized instances where teenagers on Prozac or similar antidepressants have exploded into murderous rages. Teenagers like Julie Mara Mead from Maryland, who was shot to death by the police when they found her waving a gun at them, or Ben Garris, a 16-year-old in Baltimore, who stabbed his counselor to death, or Christina Fetters, a 14-year-old from Des Moines, Iowa, who stabbed her favorite great-aunt in a rage that landed her a life sentence. Dr. Tarantolo also has written about the Julie Mara Mead. In a column in the International Center of Study of Psychiatric and Psychology News, headed Children in Prozac, First Do No Harm, Tarantolo describes how Julie Mead, in November 1996, called 911. She said she was begging the cops to come and shoot her. And if they didn't do it quickly, she would do it to herself. That's a mistake to call the cops to shoot you. Don't do that. You don't have to ask some of them. There was also the threat that she would shoot them if they did come. So now that was the message that was given. Within a few minutes, of course, the police came. Five of them, to be exact. And they obliged. They pumped 10 bullets into her head. End of her story. Well, his remarks, unquote, that a friend of Julie said that Julie had plans to make the honor roll and go to college. The friend had also observed her taking all those pills. What pills? Well, Tarantolo called the medical examiner and spoke with a Dr. Martin Bullock, who was on a fellowship at that office. Dr. Bullock said she'd been taking Prozac for 4 years. The November 23, 1996 Washington Post reported the Julie Mead death by shooting. The paper mentioned nothing about Prozac. This was left to a more penetrating newspaper, the local PG County Journal from the Maryland County in which the shooting took place. Why did the Washington Post never mention Prozac or interview any of a growing number of psychiatrists who have realized the danger of giving these drugs to children and adults? Is it because major media outlets enjoy considerable advertising revenue support from pharmaceutical drug companies? Is it because these companies have been running successful PR campaigns to keep their drug names quiet when suicide murders are reported? Another small paper, Vigo Examiner, in Terre Haute, Indiana, looked into the May 21st, 1998 murders in Springfield, Oregon. The shooter, Kip Kinkle. He was a 15-year-old freshman who had been on Prozac. First he killed his parents, then he walked into his school cafeteria and gunned down his fellow students. He killed 2 and wounded 22. He is currently awaiting trial. Vigo Examiner reporter Maureen Siloff covered the story, showing straightforward independence where many big-time reporters just don't. Siloff researched the book Prozac and Other Psychiatric Drugs by Lewis Opler. She writes, the following side effects are listed for Prozac: apathy, hallucinations, hostility, irrational ideas, paranoid reactions, antisocial behavior, hysteria, and suicidal thoughts. An explosive cocktail of symptoms. The Jonesburg, Arkansas school shooting took place on March 24, 1998. Mitchell Johnson, 13, and Andrew Golan, 11, apparently faked a fire alarm at Westside Middle School. Then when everybody came outside, the boys fired from the nearby woods, killing 4 students and a teacher and wounding 11 other people. Charged as juveniles, the boys were convicted of capital murder and battery. They can be held in jail until they're 21 years old. Dr. Alan Lipman of Georgetown University, who is one of the experts interviewed on network television after the Littleton shootings, remarked that at least one of the boys who committed suicide in Jonesboro had been treated before the incident for violent behavior. Treated how? With Prozac? With Zoloft? Combination of the antidepressants? The action of these drugs, altering the supply of brain neurotransmitter serotonin, is touted by some people as a potential cure for violence. The only problem is there is no acknowledged proof within the broad psychiatric profession that serotonin is a causative factor in violence. That is an unproven theory. But it's not the first. May 1st, 1992, Eric Halston, 20, killed 4 people, wounded 10 at his former high school in Olivehurst, California. He was sentenced to death. January 18, 1993, in Greyhurst, Kentucky, Scott Pendleton, 17, entered Dina McDavid's English class and shot her in the head. He also shot Marvin Hicks, the school janitor, in the stomach. He is sentenced to life in prison. And October 30th and February 2nd and February 29th and July 26th and February 19th, all different individuals, young people, going in and shooting people. I've got dozens of these. Dozens. What did they all have in common? They were all on antidepressants. What was unique about it? The mass media never picked up the story. This comes from the American Journal of Psychiatry, Volume 147, page 207. I'm quoting, 6 depressed patients previously free of recent suicidal ideation develop intense violent suicidal preoccupation after 2 to 7 weeks of fluoxetine, Prozac treatment, unquote. The bulk of the American media appears afraid to go after the psychiatric drugs as a cause of violent crime. This fear stems in part from the sure knowledge that the expert attack dogs are waiting in the wings, funded by big-time pharmaceutical companies. There are doctors and researchers who have seen a dark truth about these drugs in the journals, but are afraid to stand up and speak out. After all, the medical culture punishes no one as severely as its own defectors. When defection from the party line threatens profits, careers, and reputations, and when defection alerts the public that deadly effects could be emanating from corporate boardrooms, then they go to work on you. And what of the federal government itself? The Food and Drug Administration licenses each drug released for public use and certifies it as being safe and effective. If a real tornado started at the public level, if the parents of the young killers and the young victims began to see a terrible knowledge swim into view, a knowledge they hadn't imagined, and they joined forces, we would all wake up and realize that these drugs are causing the psychotic and hence suicidal or homicidal actions in so many of these young people. What is the answer? It is not to create more laws that make it more difficult for normal and proper behavior in these children. We don't need any more draconian notions. We just need to pay attention to the truth. Psychiatry has betrayed us. The drugs are deadly. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you very much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow on location, way out of New York, a long way away, and hopefully be able to start bringing you some information from my daily research. Have a nice day.